For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
And Charles, thank you so much, and to DePaul University for facilitating this. It's my pleasure to introduce Alan Sanocki, who is one of the most knowledgeable people in certainly in American Buddhism about what's going on in South Asia. He's visited the monks in Burma and more recently the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. He's also worked, and he'll talk about this, with the untouchable community of Buddhists, significant community of Buddhists in India. Alan is also, he's vice abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center, very well, large, old, well-established American Zen community. Alan also has been the president of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, and he's currently involved with the Clear View Project and the Buddhist Humanitarian Project, which is helping to raise money for Rohingya refugees. Alan and I go back quite a ways. Alan's a longtime activist as well as Zen Buddhist practitioner. We were as undergraduates at Columbia in New York. We were protesting the Vietnam War and racism in the university, and were arrested with 700 or more of our friends since 1968. So Alan has a long pedigree of activism and Buddhist scholarship and activity and teaching. So Alan, thank you very much for coming to Chicago.
Thank you, Taigen. Can you hear me okay? I apologize for sitting down, but somehow standing for a couple of hours doesn't make sense. I hope that's okay. I'm grateful to Charles for helping with the DePaul side of this talk. Thanks so much. And to Taigen, and also to from Ancient Dragon, and also Jack Lawler from Lakeside, and there's a bunch of old friends and new friends in the audience. I'm really glad to see you, and hope you'll find this interesting, and hope we'll have some interesting discussion. I want to start by just kind of, let's take a couple of moments and just ground ourselves. So find a stable, upright posture and place your feet on the ground, if you will. So we can ground ourselves in our posture and our breathing. If there are any obstructions, if there's anything blocking kind of the free passageway of air, see if you can relax it. When you've settled into your breath, it's good to just raise an intention. So you can simply raise the intention to be awake here. I don't necessarily mean physiologically awake. If you have to go to sleep, that's okay. But awake to your body, noticing that we're in a room full of people. Noticing that the world is going by outside the window. And just to be grateful for our opportunity to be here. So let's have a minute or two of silence. And when you're ready, just come back to your room. You can open your eyes. And I want to start by just dedicating our time here together. In the last, I guess it was maybe 2 weeks ago now, just about, that one of our really important teachers, Roshi Bernie Glassman, passed away in Massachusetts. He was 79 years old. And he was one of the really important figures of engaged Buddhism in the West. And I want to, there are many people that we can remember, but I want to remember Bernie, and appreciate the peacemaker community that he built. Remember his wife Eve, who's a wonderful person who also is continuing that work, and all of us who work, whether we know it or not, in the fields that he was himself working in. So Bernie took many roles in this life. You know, he was known as a Zen master, even though he set aside his robes and all the formal trappings of that. He was a social entrepreneur. He was a clown. And he was a father, a husband, a mentor. But really, to my mind, he was what they say in the Zen tradition, is a true person of no rank. He didn't. If he had the only badge I know that he wore was his clown nose, maybe his cigar. In the Yiddish, we would call him a mensch, which has the implication of a person of honor and integrity. So just to say, in 1995 or 96, Bernie with his wife Jushu Holmes, who's passed away in 98, founded the Zen Peacemaker Order. And they also, that sort of morphed into an international interfaith community called the Peacemaker Community that integrated spiritual practice and social action. And there were three core principles. We're going to be talking in the course of this afternoon about a number of sets of principles. And this is one that's not disconnected from what I had planned to speak of. But Bernie called these the three tenets. And the first tenet is not knowing, giving up fixed ideas about ourselves and about the world. So meeting each situation with a sense of curiosity, not with a sense of, I know what this is about. It's very, very much akin to what Suzuki Roshi spoke of as beginner's mind, when he said, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, and in the expert's mind there are few. The second tenet is bearing witness to the joy and suffering of the world. And I think I'll talk about this a little more at Ancient Dragon tomorrow, but bearing witness means just bringing yourself to what must be witnessed. It also means enduring, bearing what one must witness. And I think the third implication is carrying your witness back to those who are maybe not physically present right there, but making it alive for others. And the third tenet is, it got formulated, the formulation was constantly changing. One version was loving action for ourselves and the world. I've reframed that from some of my own thoughts and studies coming out of a Zen koan where someone asked Zen Master Uman, what's the meaning of the Buddha's whole lifetime? And Uman said, an appropriate response. And so that's my frame of the third tenet. So not knowing, bearing witness, an appropriate response. And I think that Bernie saw this as a practice for kind of a ceaseless inquiry. Not in some linear way, but circular. You enter a situation fresh. You have some sense of what's going on. When you offer an appropriate response, then you've created a new situation. And so you have to enter those three tenets all over again. And so you can start anywhere. Bernie wrote, when we bear witness, when we become the situation, homelessness, poverty, illness, violence, and death, the right action arises by itself. We don't have to worry about what to do. We don't have to figure out solutions ahead of time. Peacemaking is the function of bearing witness. And once we listen with our entire body and mind, loving action arises. In his last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, there's another principle that Bernie articulated, which was drawn from the Big Lebowski. There's a dialogue in the movie where Lebowski says to this guy that he's in a discourse with, say, well, that's just like your opinion, man. And what Bernie wrote was, whenever you hear anything, whenever you see anything, say, keep in mind that this is my opinion. I'm not saying this as the truth or the fact. It's just my opinion. And if you hear somebody saying something, that's their opinion. And opinions cannot be right or wrong. Those are my parting words. With that, you won't have any problems. Good luck. So I want to dedicate this afternoon to that spirit, to the spirit of not knowing, bearing witness, and responding appropriately, and with the caveat that everything I say is just my opinion, man. You know, you may have a different opinion. And if you do, I'm really open to learning from you. So, thank you, Bernie. So this talk is entitled Radical Buddhism and the Three Treasures, Liberty, Equality, and Community. And I want to start with, I've actually written this. I can't believe that I wrote this whole thing. You know, I'm going to try to do it so that it's not a kind of deadly reading, but excuse me if it gets some way. But I want to start with an epigraph from someone I will speak of in the course of this talk. One of the great figures of modern Buddhism, really the man who created this movement of liberation among the untouchables in India, Dr. B.R. Ambedkar. And what Dr. Ambedkar, one thing that he wrote was, it would be difficult to find a religious teacher to compare with Buddha, whose teachings embrace so many aspects of the social life of people, whose doctrines are so modern, and with main concern to give salvation to man in his life on earth, and not to promise it in heaven after he is dead. So that's kind of a context for kind of the Buddhist perspective on what I will share with you. So the closer we look at our lives, the more we see numberless teachers. It's a bus driver, a grandparent, a sister or brother, a ragged person on the street corner. And when we remove our blinders, we can see that each of these people can be a teacher for us. But I want to speak of three people who are particularly teachers for me over the years of practice. And those three figures are Shakyamuni Buddha, Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, and Martin Luther King Jr. Each of them inhabited their historical and time and place completely. Each of them reached millions of people. And for me, together, the twining of their teachers weaves through the fabric of my own life in a very bright and colorful and strong way, making that fabric strong. So Shakyamuni Buddha, who you all know of, lived 2,500 years ago. But his teachings and his life and his example and his practice have been transmitted now 2,500 years from warm hand to warm hand, from teacher to student to teacher to student. And we talk about this fundamental act of taking refuge. So when we take refuge in Buddha, we're actually taking refuge in all the Buddhas who are our teachers. And that includes the Buddhas of our own mind. So in that sense, the Buddha, who is a person who is long gone, is also a living being that we encounter. In the first half of the 20th century, Dr. Ambedkar led a revolutionary movement of untouchable peoples in India, seeking human and political rights. He was doing this in a country that was also rapidly moving towards independence and towards breaking with its colonial, its recent colonial past then. And Dr. Ambedkar's spiritual heirs and descendants have been my teachers for about a decade now. And I've been going to India almost every year to learn and to work in those communities to share some of the Buddhist practice and insights that I have with them in the context of living practice communities. And these are practice communities that really, to me, embody engaged Buddhism, integrating regular Buddhist practice, meditation, and social action. And the third figure is Dr. King, who led a nonviolent movement for racial equality and justice that is still unfolding. Sometimes it's unfolding. We see it's unfolding very, it's very painful. Here in our nation, this work is also going on in looking at questions of diversity and race and gender in our Buddhist communities. And he's the only one of these physical embodied beings that I actually had an opportunity to see. In the early 1960s, I was able to see Dr. King from a great distance at the March on Washington in summer of 1963. I think that was... You know, that was the summer of 10th grade for me. Me and all my friends went down to Washington. And I remember where I was standing when I heard the famous I Have a Dream speech. And I was standing with my friends. And you know what? Most of them are still my friends. And also as a teenager, I saw Dr. King and his associate, Ralph Abernathy, at a synagogue in Great Neck, my hometown. And the last encounter was not with him directly, but his assassination in April of 1968 was the catalyst for the uprising at Columbia University that Tigan mentioned. All of that unfolded really directly as a result of his death. And that was the pivotal moment of my college career, that uprising. So what these three men hold in common is that they understood and they created community as the basis, as the ground for social transformation. There's an expression from the IWW, the Wobblies, from the preamble to the Wobbly Constitution, I think about 1905. It says, build the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. And that's what each of these figures tried to do. They didn't just try to tear down the old. They built alternative social realities in hopes that this would transform what was in each case, an oppressive reality. So I resonate with that approach because for more than 50 years, I've been either looking for or living in community. In communes, remember communes? Houses, collectives, bands, that musical bands that I've been in, and sangha. And it's kind of amazing to me, I've been living in a community for 35 years at the Berkeley Zen Center, living in the same place, practicing there, raising our children there. These are not always ideal places. They're not always fun. And when you live in community, you see how hard it is to get along. It's really hard to get along, to live and work together. But how much harder it is, how limited and lonely it is to be alone. And to feel like one is stuck in this illusion of solitariness. So that's kind of the common thread that runs between these figures for me. So I'm going to start with Shakyamuni Buddha and with the principle of refuge. Across all the Buddhist traditions, there are so many doctrines and approaches and practices by which people identify as Buddhists. But it seems common to all of these traditions is what we call the three treasures or jewels. It's also known as the three refuges. In Soto Zen, I think almost all of our ceremonies, whether they're ordinations or funerals initiations, monthly bodhisattva ceremonies, they all begin with taking refuge. And this is the version of the refuge verse that comes from the Soto tradition. I take refuge in Buddha. May all beings embody the great way, resolving to awaken. I take refuge in Dharma. May all living beings deeply enter the sutra's wisdom like an ocean. I take refuge in Sangha. May all beings support harmony in the community, free from hindrance. So the title that I gave this talk mentions radical Buddhism, but I think that that's redundant because the Buddhist teachings were radical for their time and place, and they're still radical for ours. The etymology of radical, coming from the Latin, means going to or forming the root. And the first dictionary definition says something like relating to or affecting the fundamental nature of something. So the Buddha's quest was to realize the fundamental nature of being and to become free from all delusion, all ideas about how life was and what its limitations were. And he did this by going to the root of his mind. And by extension, simplifying and clarifying his activities. But what he did right away, as soon as he could, the communication of this principle of his awakening was to frame these refuges and to create a community. And he created a community with monks and then monks and nuns, and lived with them and traveled with them for 45 years. Initially, one could see the Buddha was an actual person, and one could see him and travel with him. But in time, the Buddha refuge has come to mean following the Buddha's life. There's something I borrow from Taigen. He talks about, somewhere you spoke about, when we sit upright, when we sit cross-legged, it's Buddha mudra, which means taking the posture of Buddha, literally putting our body into that position as a way of enacting our Buddha nature and our own enlightenment. The Dharma refuge traditionally means the Buddha's teachings. And these are spoken by the Buddha in dialogue with anyone who came to him asking a question or bringing up issues. And he had a remarkable acolyte, Ananda, with a photographic memory or audiographic memory, who remembered everything that the Buddha said. And then several centuries later, these were written down into in several different Indian languages into what we call the suttas or sutras. But the word dharma also has other meanings. In a sense, we can understand dharma as natural law. Like, gravity is a dharma. Nuclear fission is a dharma. It's just the way things, it's an explication of the way things work, of the way our reality is. The beating of your heart is dharma. And the life of your mind is dharma. And then at a granular level, in Buddhist psychology, dharma is the most basic moment of perception or consciousness. A fleeting sensation, a thought or emotion that arises. And that's also dharma, and we take refuge in that. In our teaching, in our tradition, basically we're taught, include everything. Fold everything into your understanding of the world, of reality. And so all of these dharmas can become our refuge. Even ones that are difficult, painful. And as Buddhism evolved, as it evolved into a sophisticated view that we know as Mahayana Buddhism, those dharmas themselves were seen as empty, in the sense, not non-existent, but that they were themselves created of other elements. In other words, you can't have a thought unless you have the flow of blood, the beating of a heart. You can't have a thought unless you were conceived and born. So everything is part of this co-construction of our bodies and minds that's always subject to change and impermanence. And so in a sense, to take refuge in dharma is actually to recognize the nature of change and impermanence and not resist it, but actually dive into it. And the third refuge is Sangha. Sangha is an idea that predates Buddhism. In Sanskrit and Pali, those Indian languages, it really means just association or community. But as the Buddha preached, Sangha developed around him. He didn't sort of consciously necessarily, he didn't create a structured community. It just sort of constellated around him. And it came to mean a four-part Sangha, which consisted of monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen. I think what I've come to think of it in the West is Sangha as the community of all beings. So these three jewels have been sort of a personal refuge for me over the last 35 years. I've had several life-threatening illnesses, and in those moments, I found myself reciting the refuge verse. Just continuously. And finding a kind of formless support from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in the middle of whatever pain or difficulty I've been having. And I think that this refuge allows us to come into contact, to be in refuge not just with not just with the Sangha of other beings, but with what the sixth ancestor of Zen called the sentient beings of my mind. And we're all familiar with these. You know, there's the part of you that is still about 8 years old, right? There's a part of you that deludedly thinks you're still about 19 years old. Although some of you may be 19 years old, I don't know. Even I find in this 71-year-old body, it's like, wait, that sentient being is still alive. There are sentient beings who are hungry ghosts that are insatiable. There's the sentient being that's a fighting demon that wants to argue with people and fight, and so on and so forth. All of these are what the sixth ancestor called sentient beings of our mind. And we have to find the refuge. In a sense, we find refuge in what Suzuki Roshi called big self, big mind, so that we can be the refuge for all the sentient beings of our mind, meeting them with unconditional love, which is irrespective of what kinds of perhaps flawed upbringings we may have had in childhood. The ideal of the parent is an ideal of unconditional love, right? So even when a parent has to act strongly or protectively, he or she is doing that in the spirit of unconditional love. And that's the attitude that we can cultivate for these beings of our own mind. So by invoking the three treasures, we are ourselves the refuge for sentient beings of our mind and for suffering sentient beings that we encounter. So these three treasures don't really exist in a kind of separateness from each other. Together, they are the enlightened activity of compassion. So in the body of the Buddha, in the mind of awakening, and in the life of relationship and community. So I just want to pause a moment and then move about 2,500 years in time. So let's go from the Buddha's time to 20th century India, which was a moment in which living Buddhism had virtually disappeared in the land of the Buddha's birth, and where, among other things, the oppressive and dehumanizing realities of a caste system were flourishing, and to some degree are still flourishing. So I imagine that there are people of Indian background, perhaps, in this room. And I want to reiterate that this is just my opinion, man. And I'm willing to learn, but this is what I've been learning from my friends in Dr. Ambedkar's movement. The Indian caste system has been evolving for several thousands of years. And there's a codification of sort of a four-caste system, the Varnas, in a text called the Laws of Manu. And it designated a priestly or Brahmin caste, a warrior or Kshatriya caste, a caste of merchants and farmers, Vaishya, and a servant layer called Shudra. And over time, these broad categorizations have broken into several thousand subcastes and subdivisions of each one. So this article I was reading said there are 3,000 castes and 25,000 subcastes. And then beneath all these groupings are a population known as the Untouchables, along with tribal peoples, also known as Adivasi. And today, these marginalized communities are often known as Dalit, which means something like broken or scattered. Under British colonial rule, this grouping was known as the depressed classes. You know, probably a lot of them were depressed. And in the Indian constitution, they're known as scheduled castes and scheduled tribes. And there's an ever-evolving roster of designation of these groups. Human Rights Watch reports India's untouchables are relegated to the lowest jobs and live in constant fear of being publicly humiliated, paraded naked, beaten, raped by upper caste Hindus seeking to keep them in their place. Merely walking through an upper caste neighborhood can be a life-threatening offense. And then they have these statistics. This is from a from, I think, a 1999 Human Rights Watch report. In rural areas, 37.8% of government-run schools make Dalit children sit separately from other children. In 27.6% of rural villages, Dalits are prevented from entering police stations. In 33% of rural villages, public health workers refuse to enter Dalit homes. In 48.4% of Dalit villages are denied access to upper caste water sources. And in 70% of the rural villages, Dalit and non-Dalit do not eat together. I don't know to what extent these statistics are still accurate. I know that there are places where things are shifting, but also in my experience, which I can talk about later, the worst of these circumstances really still continue in rural villages. Rural villages seem to be kind of the locus of the worst depression, which is why people move to the cities. So, Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar was born into a poor but educated Mahar family. Traditionally, the Mahars, which were the largest untouchable group in the state of Maharashtra, lived outside the boundaries of the village. And they worked as servants, watchmen, street sweepers, and the haulers of animal carcasses. But Ambedkar's father served in the colonial Indian Army. And so his father was schooled in Marathi, the local language, and English. And he instilled a love of learning in his children and got them, because he was in the Army, he got them admission to government schools at a time when it was very difficult for untouchable students to get into any kind of formal school. Young Bhimrao was just a brilliant student, and he won a scholarship to the University of Bombay. This is in a very early part of the 20th century. And then he won a further scholarship from the ruler of one of the princely states in Maharashtra. And with that support, Ambedkar was able to go to New York and get a PhD from Columbia. I wish that we had known about Dr. Ambedkar while we were there. Now there's a statue of him, actually. And then he went on, because he's kind of an unstoppable force. He went on, he got another PhD from the London School of Economics, and he was admitted to the bar in London. And all this by the time he was about 30. So he came back to India from the West as one of the best educated people in the country. He went back to work as a finance secretary for his benefactor, the the leader of the Baroda state. But he had an almost impossible time finding housing. And he was not able to eat with his colleagues in that office. And then when he went into law shortly after, he suffered the indignity of that his law clerks, rather than experience caste pollution, they would throw law files sort of in the direction of his desk rather than actually placing them on his desk. And this is all in his autobiography. So that what he called the hell of caste that he experienced in his youth is really, it's hard for many of us in the West to imagine, despite our own dark history of slavery and racism. Indian caste still means that there's a kind of hereditary bondage that's passed from generation to generation. And it arises in what he identified as a kind of dominant Hindu culture. And what that meant to him, some of the same language that we have in Buddhism. We have words like karma and dharma, but they mean somewhat different things. Where we see karma as an opportunity that can be turned in the moment, the implication of karma was to live out your life in dharma, which means in duty, to live out the life that you have been born into within the confines of the position that you were born into. And that rising or falling in kind of this hierarchy of beings is something that took place from life to life. At any rate, even today, there's very strict endogamy, which means marriage within one's own caste, and that ensures a kind of fixedness of that that social structure. So if you group together what you might consider the oppressed peoples in India, it's a very large percentage of the population. Between Dalit and tribal people and what's also known as other backward castes, it might range up to 40 or 50% of the population. So these are the realities that Dr. Ambedkar faced in the 20s and 30s. Between 1923 and the 50s, he worked as a tireless advocate for the rights of all Indians. And it's interesting, while Gandhi was forging a nonviolent anti-colonial movement, Ambedkar, who often clashed with Gandhi, was working for human rights and for the annihilation of caste, and against what he saw as an elite-driven nationalism. And after years of attempted collaboration, including with reformist Hindus, including Gandhi and Nehru, Ambedkar organized his own Satyagraha, which is what we know Gandhi for, a sort of truth force of thousands to draw water and drink from a reservoir that had been closed to untouchables in Bombay. By 1935, Dr. Ambedkar concluded that the dominant caste system and religious structures could not be reformed, even with support from the most open-minded Hindus. And he argued that untouchability was not an artifact, but it was a structural element in that religious tradition. And he saw caste as a system of graded inequality. And in that sense, each subcaste, even below, even within the communities of untouchables, was measuring itself above one group and below another group and creating an almost infinite factionalism, dividing exploited communities amongst themselves, making a unity of social or political purpose almost impossible. So by 1935, he said, "I was born a Hindu. I solemnly assure you that I will not die as a Hindu." And for the next 15 years, he investigated Islam, Christianity, Sikhism, and he was courted by each of these groups who were well aware that if Ambedkar sort of came to under their umbrella, he would bring with him millions of untouchables, which is a sort of a demographic and political force. By the 1940s, Ambedkar had decided that Buddhism was a logical home for his people, even though there wasn't a substantial Buddhist community in India at the time. And he saw Buddhism as essentially rational, non-discriminatory, and indigenous to India. And he wrote, "The teachings of the Buddha are eternal, but even then Buddha did not proclaim them to be infallible. The religion of Buddha has a capacity to change according to times, a quality which no other religion can claim to have. Now, what is the basis of Buddhism? If you study carefully, you will see Buddhism is based on reason. There is an element of flexibility inherent in it, which is not found in any other reason." But his plans for conversion were postponed while he was invited by India's first Prime Minister, Nehru, to be India's first law minister and to be the leader of the Constitutional Drafting Committee. I don't know if any of you, probably not many of you, have read the Indian Constitution. It's really a remarkable document. It is far and away the most progressive constitution that I've ever seen, you know, guaranteeing women's right, caste right, economic justice. All of these principles are embedded in the Constitution. Of course, like all constitutions, it would be great if it was actually enacted, but it's there. It's a remarkable document. By the mid-50s, Ambedkar had set aside his political career. And then he plunged even more deeply into Buddhism and worked towards shaping of a new identity for Dalit peoples. After a long consideration and consultation with many people, and in the face of ill health and feeling the shadow of mortality, on October 14th, 1956, Dr. Ambedkar converted to Buddhism in Nagpur, India, which is the city that I go to, the school that I work at is in. And he took the three refuges and received the ethical precepts from the senior Buddhist monk in India at that time. Then he did an unprecedented thing, particularly unprecedented for a layperson. There were 400,000 people there. And after receiving the refuges and the precepts, he turned around and he offered them to everyone present. And that was the birth of a new Buddhist movement in India. And within the next few weeks, these mass conversions continued, particularly through Maharashtra, and they continue to this day. They're still happening. And within 2 months, Ambedkar was dead. There was no hint of evil doing. It just, his body wore out from heart disease and diabetes. So in a radio broadcast in 1954, 2 years before the conversion, Dr. Ambedkar said this. He said, "Positively, my social philosophy may be said to be enshrined in three words, liberty, equality, and fraternity. Let no one, however, say that I have borrowed my philosophy from the French Revolution." Actually, he did. He said, "I have not. My philosophy has its roots in religion and not in political science. I have derived them from the teachings of my master, the Buddha." So he took the refuges in 56, but he was still also enunciating these principles of liberty, equality, fraternity. And as I consider those two sets of principles, I see a resonance or correspondence between them. So liberty is the quality of actualized liberation that was embodied by Buddha. It's the Buddha refuge. But what I would say is that enlightenment or Buddhahood, being Buddha, is not a state, but it's an activity. It's the living of an enlightened life. It's what you do. It's not who you, you know, sit on a chair and beam that you are. You really have to do something. So liberty is a practice. It's something that one can work at. And I think liberty and Buddhahood have two sort of philosophical aspects or complementary expressions. One is liberty from. In other words, to be free from delusion, to be free from suffering, to be free from individual and social oppression. And the other dimension is liberty to be free to be one's true self, free to express oneself in so many ways, free to save all sentient beings. So to be free from and to be free to go hand in hand. Equality and Dharma express each other in the sense that we see all beings as essentially equal. We all arise and pass away. We all have the same valence as beings. In the Zen tradition, Master Hakuin says, "From the beginning, all beings are Buddha." So each sentient being is precious. This is equality. And we could say, all people are chosen. All of the chosen people, not just those of some particular religion or caste or nation. And of course, at the same time, each person has particular qualities and abilities, strengths and weaknesses. But there's this fundamental equality. And in fact, in Mahayana Buddhism, we have this image of the precious jewel mirror. So when our minds are transformed and we are free from the grip of delusion, the mind itself can become like a mirror. A mirror does not pick or choose what it reflects. It reflects everything. Everything is included in the light that's gathered by the mirror and projected backwards, without discrimination, without preference. This is equality. And I'm not so comfortable with the idea, with the word fraternity. It has, I think it has a different, certainly has a different implication to us. Here we are in a college. Are there fraternities here? Yes. We're on a college campus. So I think it means something different than what it meant in the French Revolution. And also it's gendered. So let's use the word community. And that's the heart of the Buddha's. That's what Buddha needed in order to build his teachings. And this is what Thich Nhat Hanh, I believe, Thich Nhat Hanh said, the next Buddha will be Sangha. And this is still a challenge, I would say, for the communities, the Dalit communities that I work with in India. They are building their own community, but it's still very hard, not just because of lines of oppression that affect them, but also from the basis of their suffering. It's very hard for them to cross caste lines in the other direction. And there still are differences among caste communities. This is why the school that I work with, and I'd love to talk about it more, in Nagpur, is so remarkable because it's drawing about 150 young people every year. It's been running for about 15 years, 16 years now. And they're coming from all over India. And they belong to many, many different communities. And what they're having to do is what I was saying in the beginning. It's not so easy to live together. They're living together in dormitories. And what they're doing, they're working together, studying. They're meditating together 2 hours a day. And they are learning about the ways in which their lives are similar as young people, and also about the ways that their particular backgrounds are different, and coming to see them as equal in community. So I find that really hopeful. That's one of the things I've been working with. When I go over there, I've been working on community building, helping young people, particularly once they graduate from this program, to develop skills that they can work in their own communities and cross lines of caste, of education, of privilege, with some fluidity in both directions. And they're really great people. It's an honor to be able to work with these young people because they're completely alive, which is actually true of young people everywhere, right? You know, it's just the way they are. And hopefully it's the way our 19-year-old sentient peak of my mind hopefully still is too. Yours too, you too. So finally, third figure. At much the same time as Ambedkar was leading this conversion movement in India, the civil rights movement was growing in the American South. And I think that in their own cultural and historical contexts, and each in their own language, Dr. Ambedkar and Dr. King really shared so many so much of a spiritual vision of social harmony and justice. But it's interesting because King speaks frequently of Gandhi, and he was invited to India by the Gandhians. And it's not clear to me that he even knew of Dr. Ambedkar. Gandhi had a more effective brand in the West. Ambedkar wasn't really playing to the West. Although in certain outward forms, he wore business suits and he was much more overtly Western. But they were both university-educated lawyers, you know, so they could argue with each other. But Gandhi did not seem to know much about Dr. Ambedkar. But I found something as I've been studying Dr. King. There's one sort of footnote to his travels in India in 1959. And he later wrote about this. Let me read this to you. I remember when Mrs. King and I were in India, we journeyed down one afternoon to the southernmost part of India, the state of Kerala, the city of Trivandrum. That afternoon, I was to speak in one of the schools, what we would call high schools in our country, and it was a school attended by and large by students who were the children of former untouchables. The principal introduced me, and then as he came to the conclusion of his introduction, he said, "Young people, I would like to present to you a fellow untouchable from the United States of America." And for a moment, I was a bit shocked and peeved that I would be referred to as an untouchable. But I started thinking about this fact. 20 million brothers and sisters of my brothers and sisters were still smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in an affluent society. I started thinking about the fact these 20 million brothers and sisters were still, by and large, housed in rat-infested, unendurable slums in the big cities of our nation, still attending inadequate schools faced with improper recreational facilities. And I said to myself, yes, I am an untouchable, and every Negro in the United States of America is an untouchable. So Dr. Ambedkar's vision was rooted in these principles deriving from Buddha's teachings and from the European Enlightenment tradition. He called his vision Prabuddha Bharat, which means something like enlightened India. It's a kind of pure land, the Sukhavati, right here in this life. King's inclusive vision was what he called beloved community, rooted in modern Christian social teachings. So the beloved community was a principle developed by a philosopher theologian, Josiah Royce, in the early 20th century, which was a radical, it's part of an extension of the Protestant social gospel movement. Very interesting movement. Some of you might know about it. It's worth checking out. And Royce was a leading voice for nonviolent spiritual transformation. And he was the founder of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And not surprisingly, he was very familiar with Buddhism and actually went to the extent of learning Sanskrit so that he could read, he could pursue his studies. Martin Luther King took up the beloved community and placed it at the center of this vision of a new society. And the core principle, the defining characteristic of Dr. King's beloved community was agape, the kind of love that, it's a Greek word, and the kind of love that Thomas Aquinas described as to selflessly will the good of another. And Buddhists will quickly recognize this as metta, maitri. Unconditional loving kindness is expressed in the Buddha's divine abodes. King's beloved community held to these principles: nonviolence, the interrelatedness of all things, the solidarity of the human family, the equal moral status of the individual and the community, and the realization that each of us lives, quote, in the red. That means we benefit and we're in debt to others for their contribution to us. But King did not see beloved community as an abstract idealization. He saw it as a society that would be built on principles of mutual respect and nonviolence, where the conflicts that would inevitably arise would be resolved without violence and without retribution, because individuals would be trained in the philosophy and methods of violence. In the philosophy and methods of nonviolence. We are trained in the philosophy and methods of violence. We have to train in some other way. And that's actually one of our ancestors, Zen Master Dogen, said, we can only see as far as the eye of practice can reach. So this is this is where the eye of practice means our training. Our training in encountering ourselves, our training in encountering others. And this is the training, I think, that Dr. King was speaking of. And that kind of training, when you look at the history of the civil rights movement, we see these confrontations and these really courageous acts. What we don't see much about is that a lot of the early civil rights activists, people who were integrating lunch counters, who were freedom riders riding in public transportation in the South, before they did those things, they went for intensive training in nonviolence. A lot of them trained with a man named Jim Lawson, who was teaching at Oberlin, who's a Methodist minister. And he's the man that invited Dr. King to Memphis in his last activities. But this training would be philosophical and it would be practical. It would be role play, where you would play not just the civil rights activist, but you would play the oppressor. And if any of you have ever done role play, it's really amazing work, because you can very quickly get into the role that you're playing and you see how that being is within you. You can be the oppressor. You can contact the fear and even the hatred that you may have in yourself, and then you have to step back from it. But once you see that, it opens something. It opens a realm of possibility and opens a realm of compassion for us. The King Center offers this description of beloved community. Dr. King's beloved community is a global vision in which all people can share in the wealth of the earth. In the beloved community, poverty, hunger, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international standards of human decency will not allow it. Racism and all forms of discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice will be replaced by an all-inclusive spirit of sisterhood and brotherhood. What Dr. King said in 1956, after a Supreme Court desegregation ruling that ended the Montgomery bus boycott. He said the end of beloved, the end of this conflict is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform opposers into friends. It is this love which will bring about miracles in the hearts of men. But how do we get to this beloved community or Pure Land? Dr. King spoke of this in his first book, and I think this resonates with the Buddhist teachings and with Dr. Ambedkar's own kind of liberation spirituality. Dr. King talks about nonviolence. Only through nonviolence can this goal be attained, for the aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation and the creation of beloved community. So, just to come to a stopping point rather than an end, I want to suggest that the path to a beloved community includes failure. All of our great spiritual and political teachers met with failure and even defeat. And I think that this is part of the, maybe it's part of the zeitgeist that we're experiencing now, which is a painful time. But if we think of the Hebrew prophets, if we think of Jesus, if we think of Joan of Arc, of Abraham Lincoln, of Gandhi, Ambedkar, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, every one of them suffered loss. Some of them suffered martyrdom. And all the while, they never let go of their vision and of meeting that vision with the practices that we would identify in Buddhism as the perfections of patience and effort, of shanti and virya. So it's true, I don't want to propose that suffering is redemptive. This is a sort of a philosophical problem. Is suffering redemptive? You know, I think that it's a problem, maybe it's a problem particularly in Christianity, because I think it's positive that Christ's suffering was redemptive for us. I'm not a Christian. I certainly appreciate so much about the teachings of Christ. But for myself, I can't see that suffering in and of itself is redemptive. In some cases, it divides us from one another. It has us reflexively turn inward and away. You know, we form a ball to protect ourselves. But I also find that in relationship and community, we can turn towards each other, even in our suffering. And we've seen this. We've seen whole communities that have been transformed by the suffering that they hold and process in common. We had, a few years ago, a murder of one of our community members, right across the street from the Zen Center. And it was a, really a terrible and completely senseless act. I mean, we still don't know why it happened, although the perpetrator was caught and tried, but we still don't know. He was a young man, whether he was on drugs or whatever, we don't know. But we through practice, through ceremony, through just pulling various aspects of the community together multiple times, there was something that enabled us to do by which we grew. Still, with these losses, I feel like we have a Martin Luther King-shaped hole in our American society. We have that space for the person that we lost in our community. And yet there's also something that we learn and continue. And we can discover what we share in our suffering and in our joy. And painfully continue to open and to continue to grow in our humanness. So I think I want to stop there. This leaves us about 20, 25 minutes for conversation, but I know there's a lot of stuff that I just laid out for you, and I'm happy to talk about any of it. Some of you also, you may be interested in the work that I've been involved in India. You also might want to know about aspects of the situation in Burma with the Rohingyas, or about engaged Buddhism in general. The floor is open. Don't all speak at once. Well, that's really interesting, because I was reading last night, there's a new book, the title might be What is Enlightenment? But a new book by the Buddhist scholar Dale Wright, who talks, What is Buddhist Enlightenment? Yes. And it begins by talking about this notion of unconditionality. And where he begins, which is very interesting, is with talking about something that Thich Nhat Hanh wrote in an op-ed around the time of the Rodney King beatings, where towards the end of the op-ed, what Thich Nhat Hanh said was, I am responsible for what happened there. And this goes into a large speculation about kind of the stepping aside from preference, stepping aside from a kind of partiality of responsibility, but it means totally taking responsibility for everything that happens. because if by nature everything is interconnected, then there is an equality of responsibility. So what this says to me is, it's like, personally, what I feel is, yes, there certainly is. I make decisions of preferentiality, but I also understand that human suffering is a universal characteristic, and I think that the task of a bodhisattva is to meet each person according to what they need. So, of course, if you're working in a deeply impoverished community, you know, that's what's right in front of you, and that's where your work is going to be. The position of non-preferentiality is an abstraction to me. You know, you may say from a Buddhist perspective of the absolute, that's logical and correct. From a human perspective, my attention goes where there's a suffering that I can meet. But that's just really just my opinion. And I would say there are people, and I've met them, who would argue, short of enlightenment, how can you make those decisions? You know, how can you make those decisions? But, you know, I've never met a so-called enlightened person. It's what I said before, I believe in enlightened activity. And enlightened activity, that's why I ended with this piece about failure, which means we all have our shortcomings, we all have our gaps of perception and knowledge, and we recognize that even the well-intentioned things that we do can go wrong. One of the things that I've been learning working in issues of diversity within the Buddhist community is, I think for many years, the emphasis in my thinking and about practice was on intention. I think we also need to think about impact. Intention is really important, but we have to see what are the results of activity based on that intention. And I think we have constantly to see if our intention and our actions are leading in a wholesome direction, which means a direction of connection, or if we see that there are forces working within us that are dividing us, unconsciously perhaps. And this is why we need community. We need good friends to help us see what's going on, because we may not be able to see it alone. Other thoughts? That was a rather complicated answer to that question.
Yes.
yes, and we have to remember that they have to go back to this principle. Start looking really closely at things, and the wholesome can contain unwholesome elements. And wholesome activities, so this is one of the things about the way I think about mindfulness. I have a lot of thoughts about mindfulness, but that word, the word sati or smriti, which we use for mindfulness, more technically means remembering. And just if you think about it a moment, if you remember one thing, you're going to forget something else, right? You can't remember everything. You can't keep everything in mind at one time. So even if we see mindfulness as the application of attention, if we turn our mind in one direction, there's something else that we're not seeing. And we have to be really open and fluid in the direction of our mind. This is why one of the images of Avalokiteshvara has 10 heads looking in all these different directions. So we may not have 10 heads, but we may have 5 friends. And they can help us. Yeah.
Thank you for your talk and coming, Steve.
Yeah.
From your perspective, what are the most important challenges and possibilities for American engaged Buddhism in the coming years?
Well, I don't exactly know what engaged Buddhism is. But I think that one of the challenges for Buddhism is, well, there's two challenges that sort of go very closely with each other. One is the challenge of various dimensions of diversity. That means gender, means ethnicity, race, means class. And very closely related to that is the problem of commodification, which means turning Buddhism into something that can be marketed and sold. And the relatedness is that marketing and selling is going to go to the people who have the money to buy. And so that gets back to the diversification. So I think it really means building, what I want to see is building an equitable communities, practice communities of whatever type. And also for me, I want to remember where Buddhism comes from. And that means quite literally the teachers and the teachings. So it means being grounded in basic Buddhism to the extent that we can make Buddhism our own with some sense of authenticity. And it also means remembering the teachers and the traditions and the places that it came from. And I'll say, to give you an example from another modality of... So one of my other identities is as a musician. And I've been playing different kinds of American traditional music mostly from the American South, rooted in both white and black traditions. And I've been doing this for more than 50 years. And what me and my friends did was we really studied this music as closely as we could. First of all, listening to all the recordings. Then going and playing with the master musicians who were still alive. And learning about their music, also learning about their lives and the cultural context in which these musics evolved. And in time to go return to our communities, and it's like, well, I'm not from Southeast Louisiana. I'm not from North Carolina. I'm not from Georgia. And I can play this music with real confidence and skill. Ultimately, one has to make it one's own and express oneself through these tools, but know where it comes from. And I think that I think those principles apply to Buddhism. Yeah. Yes.
I'm wondering if part of the issue with Buddhism has been the way it's structured now. It's like there's a star system, you know, of Buddhist teachers who have retreats sometimes in resort areas, etc. And more of that, more of the teaching of Buddhism seems to happen in those contexts than in local, you know, in local, with local sanghas.
I don't agree. I think it's safe to say, in those terms, my teacher is not a star. Would you agree? He's not, his face has never been on the cover of a magazine. You know, he's not particularly charismatic. He's been quietly sitting in one place in Berkeley for literally 50 years. He has 30 Dharma successors who are all over the country. And I think that's more the rule than the exception. You know, Bernie was a star, yeah, in a sense. But, you know, here's June, who was a student in his lineage. There's so many people that are just, you may hear their names, but they're not stars. They're working with their communities. And I think that's one of the rules. The problem of commodification is exactly what concerns me, is that the magazines, and there's really only a few, it's a pretty marginal magazine business, but you see the same people on those covers. And I have to say, most of them are really good teachers. You know, it's not, once commodification gets rolling, it's very hard to step aside from it and say, no, not me, you know. But I just think that most of what's going on is in the building of community. And I do trust that process. Yeah.
That's very good.
I would guess people I haven't seen any of that. I've been aware that something's been going on behind me, but, you know, it's like that's not where my attention was trying to be. But if I were walking around, walking along there, I just said, well, I wonder what's going on in there. And, you know, some people may have also wondered, oh, does that look interesting, or do I want to? Would I want to check it out? I don't know. That's a bit hypothetical. But people are natural. When people see other people gathered and looking like maybe they're interested in what's going on, they might actually think maybe there's something interesting going on. You know, maybe I could check it out, which is great. That's like the human instinct. It's terrific. Right. So you were very fortunate. Right. Right. Well, that's great. And, you know, you were lucky, and I just had to sit here looking at you.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry too. Yes. Right.
What you know, not know the answer, and then my mind
was right. We so this is a great, let me just say, this is a wonderful human capacity that we have, story making. It's really terrific. I love stories. You know, I also, as a matter of principle, a story is just an opinion. You know, it's just a narrative you have about something, and it's great to enjoy it, just you don't have to believe it. You don't know what the hell was going on with that guy. So that's what he taught you. What he taught you was, I don't know what's going on for that guy. You know, looks like suffering. But how do I not make, I'm really glad I didn't see him. How do I not make that my suffering? Your suffering. Yeah. Yeah, this is.
And you can see that.
Well, this is great theater, right?
No, we're on stage.
For him.
For him. And then.
No, no, you're on stage. We're on stage for him, but he's on stage for you.
Yes.
You know, and he's upstaging me. That's really unfair. Which kind of judgment?
It's just a separate experience that he's having and that I'm having.
It's definitely, it's his, he's having his experience, you're having your experience, and the universe is having its experience that includes all of it. Yeah, here.
Oh, you know, I don't know where I go with this, but can you? Since our question, you know, these questions of
diversity within the Buddhist community, the formerly American Buddhist communities, and so on and so forth. But I was also thinking, you know, with your talk and you know, the sort of commonalities and sort of similar sorts of inspirations that you could draw from Shakyamuni Buddha and from Ben Carr and from Dr. King. You know, sort of this idea of, like, you when you talked a couple times, said, well, it's just my opinion now. And in some ways, you know, Buddhism, you know, for many of us here, I mean, it's that's just my language, man. And it's like...
Yes.
And that brings me to I mean, I'm not as familiar with what the Blasphemy is doing, but this idea that, you know, one way to build diversity within the community, not necessarily, but still the sort of self-identified Buddhist community, it's just, you know, interacting with this wide range of people in the way that you sort of see, you know, the Zen peacemakers or became the Zen,
the peacemaker community.
Peacemaker community, and as you were talking to,
yeah,
you know, Christians and Jews and Muslims, and I mean, I don't want to be sort of Pollyannish about it, but you know, I just sort of find myself wondering if we just sort of make that kind of you know, willingness to speak our language to other people who are maybe speaking a different language and are sort of open to that. If some of these things may just sort of over time naturally have a tendency to work themselves out. I mean, I think there's Leif Pohl who got consciously working on those questions and forcing and so on within
Yeah, I don't think they need to work themselves out, though, as some merging.
No.
You know, this is, I just recently went to a memorial for one of my oldest friends who's a musician, and there were the whole audience, there was about 150 people, mostly musicians, who played a variety of styles. And they just all honored each other's styles, you know, without, that's what I love about musicians. It's like, it's all sound and music, and they recognize what they've learned and recognize other people have learned other things. Yes, we need to be able to talk to each other and not necessarily merge. Yeah. Maybe one more.
Perhaps you could say a word or two about your experiences with the Rohingya and about the letter that we have copies of here.
Yes. Are there copies of it here? Boy, a word or two. I went to the Bangladesh with somebody led by a man named Malik Mujahid. Do people know him? He's a Chicagoan, an imam. He has a radio program called Sound Vision. He's a really good guy. I tried to contact him. He's out of town. But we went and we were bearing witness to the reality of these Rohingya refugees, a Muslim ethnic group that's been driven out of Burma. You know about this, right? And it was quite... It just was stunningly painful. And I've written about it. I can give a link to a long piece I've written about it. But we're trying to... Jack Lawler was writing something the other day about a Senate bill, Senate S-2060, which is I think it's called the Burma Human Rights, Freedom and Human Rights Act, or something like that, of 2018. And it's stuck in the Senate. It's been reported out of the Foreign Relations Committee, but it's being blocked by Mitch McConnell for coming up. And so there's a letter which gives you some of the background. And then there's on the other side of the page is a draft letter for you to write to your senator and ask them to try to move forward on this bill. And there'll be more information also on my website, Buddhist Humanitarian Project, where we talk about the background, and also if you want to donate, I've raised more than $30,000, for direct Rohingya relief, and, continuing to raise money and continuing to send it through a very reputable nonprofit that's working in Bangladesh, in the camps. There's so much more I can say about it, but that's maybe another talk. So thank you very much.
Thank you for willing.